continuing with the chapter called Attending to the Deathless. Yesterday we were looking at that exchange between Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Anuruddha that led to his enlightenment, and the shift of view arising from the encouragement of Venerable Sariputta to not attend to those qualities of mind, the effect of the divine eye, seeing the thousandfold cosmos, energy being aroused, mindfulness established and unshaken, body calm and unaroused, and mind concentrated. And Venerable Sariputta encouraged Venerable Anuruddha, rather than dwell upon those qualities, to turn his attention to attend to the deathless instead, the Amata Dhamma. So continuing with the same theme. It's also worthy of note that the wording of the Venerable Sariputta's advice implies that it is just a change of perspective, a different locus of attention that is needed, not a scrapping of all that has gone before. A simple analogy is the refocusing of the eyes in such a way as to see the computer-generated hidden 3D images in a magic eye picture, rather than a meaningless blur. Furthermore, inclining the mind, attending to the deathless is usually expressed in the phrase, this is peaceful, this is exquisite, etc., underscoring that this shift of perspective does not just mean seeing things from a different angle, it refers instead to a realization of the presence of a dimension of peace and beauty hitherto unappreciated. It also needs to be stressed that Venerable Anuruddha was an anagami, a non-returner, quote-unquote, thus at the penultimate stage of enlightenment, when this exchange with Venerable Sariputta took place. Many of his spiritual qualities were extremely ripe, and without that ripeness, the immense preparation necessary for a full understanding of the nature of reality, the breakthrough to full enlightenment, could not have come so swiftly. It takes more than a capacity to see the hidden dimensions of a magic eye picture to fully liberate the heart. When Lumpur Pasanno and I were preparing this book, I had suggested that perhaps we could include one of those magic eye pictures with a Buddha image sort of hidden in the blur that's apparent at the surface level, and I got a very definite niet. It's very clear that was not a good idea. For some people, it's not difficult to see those three-dimensional images hidden within the apparent blur. For other people, it's extremely difficult, if not impossible. And so it was felt it wasn't a particularly helpful inclusion in the book. So I recall there was not a lot of discussion.
There wasn't much discussion.
But no, not a good idea. Nevertheless, I do feel that in a way it echoes to some small degree that encouragement of Venerable Sariputta. Is like you're looking at this in the wrong way. The way you're focusing on your field of experience and the way the mind is attending, you're missing a dimension that is present, but you're not aware of it, you're not seeing it, you're not appreciating that. All analogies are partial, as I mentioned before, and I think most of us would understand that any kind of metaphor or simile, any analogy can only partially match that. But I do feel that to some degree it's a good representation of how the attention can get very, very firmly focused on conditioned things, even very wholesome conditioned things. Like Anagarika Deepa was asking about unworldly feelings, that the mind can be focused on all these states of great clarity and brightness, energy that are spoken about in the jhana states, of the form jhanas or the formless jhanas. These are extremely wholesome objects. They're mind objects, and the mind can focus very substantially upon them, along with our ordinary everyday reality of the floor, the ceiling, other human beings, the air we breathe, the food we eat, the place where we live, the clothes we're wearing, the conversations that we have, and the other very familiar sensory objects that occupy our day and our senses. We can get so drawn into both the day-to-day activity and the elements of that, and also in terms of meditation, the inner world, we can get so drawn to the objects and cultivating meditation to refine the objects or to rearrange the objects, that attending to the deathless, to the shift of perspective, to attend to that which is not an object. The unconditioned is not a thing in the realm of other things. Timelessness is not just a very, very short period of time. It's a different dimension altogether. And so that change of view, that change of perspective, that I feel is the significant element here. The Buddha's description of his own enlightenment, Chakung Udapadi, vision arose, Jnanang Udapadi, knowledge arose, Panya Udapadi, as is written on the doors and as we recite very regularly in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, it's that kind of vision. That's the vision that arose. That's the knowledge, the wisdom, the light, the awareness that arose with the Buddha's enlightenment. That radically different view, way of seeing things and appreciating what has always been present. The fundamental reality, the Dhamma that's always been present, but was not appreciated, was not apprehended, was not noticed because of the preoccupation of the mind with sense objects, you know, coarse or refined sense objects. Now, any thoughts or comments on that?
Oh, what's coming to mind is the contrast between the vipassanupakilesa, the defilements of insight, and then the vipassanayanas, the insight knowledges, and actually like the defilements of insight are all the really interesting and exciting things.
People might not be aware of some of those.
Yeah, you know, I'm getting old, so remembering these lists is...
a few out of
them. But it's I mean, there's the very first one is luminosity, obasa, and unremitting...
Energy.
Steady mindfulness, all of those things can be defilements of insight. Whereas what is the knowledge of vipassanayana, insight knowledges, are impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self.
Not very glamorous.
Not very glamorous, yeah. The drawbacks of sensuality, all of that.
Any questions, comments? I'm quite fond of magic eye pictures myself, so I was biased in that particular.
I mean, I like them too, but I didn't
think giving it a bit too much weight to include it in our tome. Okay, so to continue. The term the deathless element, quote unquote, amata dhatu, that's A-M-A-T-A, amata, not amateur, amata, amata dhatu, the deathless element, was mentioned above earlier in this chapter, with the suggestion that it is synonymous with the unconditioned, the asankata dhamma. It might be useful, however, to look briefly at the origin of the term, particularly since both deathless and element, in English at least, can carry a tone of thingness with them, and thus convey an unintended concrete quality. On this point, a contemporary Buddhist scholar, Stephen Collins, from Cambridge University, I think, is worth quoting. His proposition is that amritang in Sanskrit, amata in Pali, is a classic Vedic reference to, and this is Stephen Collins from his book, Selfless Persons, an essential timelessness or a timeless essence, both preceding and in some sense underlying the ordered human world of time. This is the immobile hub of the moving wheel of time, the still point, pada, beyond the ceaseless movement of samsara. And that still point, languaging, is very, very common in Lumpur Sumato's teachings. That has occurred in his Dhamma talks many times over the years, and also in poems of T.S. Eliot, in particular when he talks about the still point of the turning world. I believe that's in the Four Quartets, one of the themes that T.S. Eliot focuses upon. The still point that's at the center of the turning world. It's not turning, but it's at the center of the world of movement. Again, all analogies are partial, and a point in terms of mathematics or physics has no dimensions, but it's an image, it's a way of representing that quality, the center of the circle, the center of the cyclone, the very center, which is not moving but is surrounded by movement. That still point of the turning world is Stephen Collins' way of representing that deathlessness or timelessness. Okay, The following passage is similar to the first one of this chapter, both in its description of the practice of attending to the deathless and in the dialogue from which the discourse takes its provenance. The Buddha has asked the assembly, Bhikkhus, do you remember the five lower fetters as taught by me? So this is sutta number 64 in the middle-length discourses. It's the discourse to Malunkya. Malunkyaputta was one of the Buddha's disciples. He appears a few times in the suttas, often with deluded views, and he gets set straight once or twice. And this one, he starts off seeming to be doing pretty well. So the Buddha says, Bhikkhus, do you remember the five lower fetters as taught by me? The Venerable Malunkyaputta responds by saying, yes, that he does. But when he recites the list, apparently correctly, to his astonishment, the Buddha responds, Malunkyaputta, to whom do you remember my having taught the five lower fetters in this way? And he got the list right. He was correct. The first one, self-view. Yeah, second one, skeptical doubt. The third one, attachment to conventions, silabhatta paramasa. The fourth one, karma raga, sense desire. And the fifth one, vyapada, ill will. So he got the list correct, but then the Buddha surprises him by saying, when have you ever heard me talk about it in that way? The Buddha goes on to say, would not the followers of other sects confute you? That means to argue against you or prove you wrong or incorrect, with the simile of the infant, a little baby, a child. The Buddha then outlines this simile and shows how, quote, a young, tender infant lying prone, unquote, could be said to be free of the five lower fetters. Personality view, sakkayaditti, skeptical doubt, vichikicca, attachment to rules and conventions, silapatta paramasa, sensual desire, kamaraga, and ill will, vyapada. And so with each of those, he says, a baby doesn't have self-view, doesn't even have a language to think of itself. A baby doesn't have skeptical doubt about the path. A baby is not attached to rules and conventions. And so, is the baby enlightened? This is his way of saying, you have to be careful how you phrase these things, because followers of other groups can say the way you're talking about freedom from these five fetters, the Sangyojana, they could say, a little baby has the same qualities. So, rather like Venerable Anuruddha, the wind is taken out of Malunkyaputta's sails, but in due course, he also gets provided with a much more profound understanding of the Dhamma. So the Buddha goes on to say, here, a bhikkhu enters upon and remains in the first jhana, experiencing refreshment and pleasure born of withdrawal, accompanied by applied and sustained thought. He regards whatever phenomena there are there that are connected with the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations and consciousness as impermanent, unsatisfactory, a disease, a cancer, a barb, painful, an affliction, alien, as disintegrating, void, as not self. He turns his mind away from those states and having done so, inclines his mind towards the property of deathlessness, recognizing this is peaceful, this is exquisite, the stilling of all mental processes, the relinquishment of all the paraphernalia of becoming, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. Standing there, he reaches the end of the mental outflows, the asava. Or if not, then through that very Dhamma passion, that's Dhamma raga, or that Dhamma delight, Dhamma nandiya, and from the total ending of the first five of the fetters, he is due to be reborn in the pure abodes, there to attain final nibbana, never again to return from that world. So those qualities, we did come across many of these in earlier readings. The stilling of all mental processes is sabbasankhara samatha. The relinquishment of all the paraphernalia of becoming, which is a number of long English words, is sabupadi patinitsago. The ending of craving is tanha kaya, not kaya as in the body, but kaya with a k-h-a-y-a, kaya. Dispassion, viraga, cessation, nirodha, nibbana. This is very significant how he's saying that through the arising of that insight or that letting go, then the mind gets overexcited or that, wow, this is amazing, this is incredible. There's that Dhamma raga, the Dhamma passion, Dhamma ragena, Dhamma delight, Dhamma nandiya, the mind getting sort of drunk on its insight or carried away, over enthusiastic, as the kind of giddy quality that might arise on account of those insights, that change of vision, then that pair of qualities, Dhammaraga and Dhammanandi, become a bit of an obstacle, to the point that there isn't the realization of full enlightenment, but rather the realization of the anagami. So that phrase of is due to be reborn in the pure abodes, there to attain final nibbana, never again to return from that world, that's a way of speaking about the quality of anagami, a non-returner. Again, as we mentioned in some of the other readings, if a being reaches the level of anagami, that level of realization at the death of the body, then they are born in one of the five Sudavasa, these five high Brahma worlds, where non-returners reappear. They are born spontaneously, they just pop into being, they don't have a mother and father, they just spontaneously arise in those realms, and they are guaranteed not to fall into a lower realm from those five Sudavasa, and they're at some point in their lifetime or lifetimes in the Sudavasa, they will realize full and complete enlightenment. The same wording is repeated with reference to the other three rupa jhanas, so second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, and similarly for the first three are rupa jhanas. So that's the levels of concentration, absorption based on formlessness. The two uppermost realms of concentration, called the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, and the cessation of perception and feeling, Nirodha Samapatti, they are considered to be, or understood to be, too refined a basis to allow any investigative reflection of this type. So it's very significant, because sometimes people talk about these very intense states of concentration, that no kind of thought, no kind of verbalization can happen. But in this representation here in the sutta, it's saying that there can be, even if it's not put into words, there can be that reflective appreciation, even into the realms of arupa jhana. That's only the two highest, extremely refined states of concentration, that even that degree of reflection of this is impermanent, this is conditioned, this is unsatisfactory, and so on and so forth. To me, it's a very, very significant little sutta, and it's got a lot within that. But I also feel that when it's spelled out in words, that he regards whatever phenomena there that are connected with the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness as impermanent, unsatisfactory. That's a regarding. It doesn't mean to say there's necessarily a verbal naming, but there is a quality of contemplation. In a dialogue with Lumpo Cha in the collected teachings, there's a dialogue called What is Contemplation? And in that, Lumpo Cha saw what is wise reflection, Yoniso Manasikara or Dhamma Vijaya. And in that, Lumpo Cha points out also that contemplation doesn't have to be involving conceptual thought. That contemplative mode where wise reflection is being applied doesn't necessarily mean thinking. And in the English usage of the word, it generally does. We say contemplating something is like picking up an idea and chewing over a conceptual thought. But in that dialogue with Lumpo Cha, and I would say it's not spelled out here, but I feel it's implied here, that reflective quality can be applied even in profound states of concentration, but that doesn't mean to say that the mind is necessarily thinking in composed sentences or words, but there can be that quality of wise reflection that is being used. Yeah, there's a lot in that. Malunkyaputta's rather like Vachagota, he got things wrong regularly, but his wrongness was a cause for the Buddha giving some wonderful teachings. Any thoughts, comments on the...
No, at all.
Any questions, please? Yes, Ajahn Kachana.
Do you have any suggestions as to how to strengthen that ability, our ability in sort of non-conceptual investigation?
More practice. In a way, it's setting the intention towards that and recognizing that possibility. So can this be considered in a non-verbal way? I mean, we do use that assessment of a present situation and guide our actions and attitudes non-verbally, say with music, with sports, with dancing. These are non-verbal activities. They're very involving. There are patterns being followed and the mind is attuning to the present situation, but it's not involving conceptual thought or verbal thought. So we do know how to do that as human beings, attuning to the present, even with worldly activities like playing a sport or following a piece of music. It's not something totally alien to us, but if the habit of mind is very much to go towards words, which mind does, then it can seem like, well, how can you reflect without words?
Huh?
But just raising that as a possibility, okay, let's look at this. How can the mind feel out this situation and not turn it into a word or not conceptualize? I'd be interested to hear what Lumpur has to say. It's that quality of attunement to the present experience, that attuning, rather like balancing or say being in harmony with the chanting or with music, or it's a quality that can be cultivated, and maybe a word or two is helpful to lead into that, but the actual attuning and balancing is non-conceptual, non-verbal, it's non-personal. Do you have any thoughts on that, Ajahn?
Well, I think one of the things is practicing to turn attention onto the mind itself. Just that sense of redirecting attention back on the mind rather than following through with the thoughts, which tend to lead out, but bringing the attention back onto the mind itself. And it is, it's getting a feel for it.
Yes, Anagarika, Jonathan.
Would you say that way of reflecting using non-conceptual thought is more effective or more penetrative than using verbalization?
It's going to vary from one individual to another. I think that dialogue with Lumpur Cha is very, very helpful. It's called What is Contemplation? And it's a conversation between him and a number of Western monks. You were there, weren't you? Was Ajahn Jagra was leading the...
Ajahn Jagra was there. That was the, if I remember, I think it was the Punsa that he was at Bangkok.
Oh, right, yes.
And
yes,
I wasn't there for the Punsa. Mm.
The kind of advice I would give is try it out and see what results come from that. Things are going to vary from one person to another on account of different conditioning. Lumpur Cha is recommending it. And also, I think particularly talking to a bunch of Westerners who think too much, particularly useful. So it's like if you've heavily developed one particular area, then going quite consciously in a different direction or cultivating areas where you're not so heavily conditioned or got such strong habits can be a useful thing. If that's a well-worn track to always go down the realm of words and conceptual thought, then to develop the skills and not follow that habit, to use different approaches to open things up in a different way, because it can be a skillful means to get away from the deeply ingrained habits of mind that can be sort of obstructive and very easily identified with. That makes sense?
Yes, certainly.
Yes.
So in contemplation, there would still be a mental movement, but not a translation of that movement into words. Is that more or less?
Something like that, yes. Well, like I said, I feel the word attunement is very helpful. Sati Sampajanya is that attuning of the mind to the field of experience. And then that attunement then brings with it a quality of pattern recognition, seeing how things fit together and relate with each other. It's not necessarily spelling that out with words, well, like with music. You know, I'm not a musician, but I've done a lot of chanting. And so attuning to the other voices that are there, or needing to ignore certain voices that are off-key or going at a strange rhythm or whatever it might be, that...
that we're all familiar with.
We're all familiar with. So there's an attunement, there's a recognizing of the patterns that are at work, how things relate with each other. It's not having to spell that out and saying, oh, that voice is three notes above the home note, he's doing that wrong, or that, and therefore I am going to do this to counteract that. It doesn't have to be verbalized at all. But there's a knowing of what's there, recognizing of the patterns, and a responsivity in relationship to the patterns that are being recognized. Pattern recognition sounds a bit technical, but it's kind of the way that's what we're doing. We're recognizing how the elements of the natural world relate to each other. In a way, it's like Dhamma Niyama, the lawfulness of how the natural world functions and how things relate to each other and function in connection with each other. And so it's the heart attuning to that way that the world works. And then the choices that come from that, to push forward, hold back, a bit left, a bit right, then that's coming from that attunement, not conceptual. Many of us have probably had that experience with chanting, for example. Particularly if you're leading it, if you have the thought, what does the next line begin with? What's the first word of the next verse? You're toast, as they say. You're done. You know what the next verse begins with. But as soon as you have the idea about it, then it's like... I've had the experience at the retreat at IMS, 100 people in the shrine room, kneeling down in front of the shrine, light the candles and the incense. How does it begin? Couldn't remember your soul. Just gone, because it's like, this is really important. I'm leading the chanting, there's 100 people in the room. How does it begin? Because of thinking about it. When you really know. So attuning to the situation and not laying an extra veneer of conceptualization on top of it, and then trusting that attunement. The very first sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, I think we quote in this book.
I read it all.
You did, really. A devata asked the Buddha, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" Transcending the experience of samsara. "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you crossed the flood?" "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I crossed the flood." It's kind of all-purpose life advice. To me, that's that quality of non-conceptual, non-personal attuning, not thinking about it. And by not halting, by not straining, then the flood is crossed. So to the conceptual mind, it's like, but what am I supposed to do? He likes to have a formula or a plan, but the way of the Buddha and the way of awakenedness, I think it's no accident they put that as sort of sutta number one in the first chapter of the Samyutta. That's the representation of that attunement, the heart bringing itself into harmony with Dhamma, not pushing, not holding back. It can be frustrating to the mind that wants some more detail or specificity. To me, it's representing that kind of balancedness and the responsivity to the present experience. Yes?
Something that occurs to me is contemplating feelings, particularly painful feelings. If you place the attention on a painful feeling and just notice how it changes, it would seem very strange to have a, like a running verbal commentary. It would just seem unnatural. Yeah. So it feels like a very natural, contemplating feelings, a very natural thing to do without a verbal running commentary. It was being in pain, I guess. It would seem very strange to have some running commentary.
Different minds work in different ways. Another person's experience can be having a very thorough commentary, sub-commentary going on the different nuances of their painful feelings for an hour and a half. You know, so minds vary a great deal. Yes?
Use the example of sport and what was the other one?
Dancing, music.
One of the things that came to me was upatakking that we see here, which is a non-verbal attention that is not over-involved. What's the word, when you're disassociated. It came to mind when I saw Venerable Chittadhammo would come in at the end of puja to help Longpo Pasano get up, and it was really lovely. It was like he was watching to see just the right moment, and it was wordless. Oh, that's a good way to work with.
That's our dance.
Yeah.
Allowable dancing. Exactly. If you overdo it, you get swept away. If you don't do enough, then you sink. Just the right amount, podi. In many, many ways, just learning what the right amount is. When to be still, when to act, when to speak, when to be quiet, that's all contained in that same fundamental principle. Okay, so to continue a little. Here is a passage from the Itiwuttaka on a similar theme. This was said by the Blessed One. Bhikkhus, there are these three elements. What three? The form element, the formless element, and the element of cessation. That's the Nirodha Dhatu. So Rupa Dhatu, Arupa Dhatu, Nirodha Dhatu. There are these three. By fully understanding form and not getting stuck in formless states, they are released into cessation, with death left in their wake. Having touched with his own person the deathless realm that can't be owned, all grasping relinquished, all taints gone, the awakened one displays the sorrowless state that's free from stain. In the purity of unhindered awareness, in turning away from concern with the conditioned, the holy, peaceful and clear reality is revealed. That was Itiwuttaka Sutta 51. And then another very interesting sutta, this is from the Book of the Nines in the Numerical Discourses. Venerable Ananda is recounting his experience. Once, friend, when I was staying in Saketa, at the game refuge in the Black Forest, the nun Jartila Bhagika went to where I was staying, and on arrival, having bowed to me, she stood to one side. As soon as she had stood to one side, she said to me, "The concentration whereby neither pressed down nor forced back, nor with mental formations kept blocked or suppressed, still as a result of release, contented as a result of stillness, and as a result of contentment, one is not agitated. This concentration is said by the Blessed One to be the fruit of what?" I said to her, "This concentration is said by the Blessed One to be the fruit of awakening." That description that she's giving there, describing her own quality of meditation and insight, I felt that was very reminiscent of the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, Sutta number 140 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is where the Buddha is speaking about the conceit of identity. And this is the dialogue between the Buddha and Pukkhusati. They were sharing the potter's shed, and at the beginning of the conversation, Pukkhusati didn't realize who he was sharing the shed with, and then during the course of the Buddha's explanation, Pukkhusati realized, "Oh, I went forth under my own initiative to be a disciple of the Buddha, and I think I'm sharing a room with him." So in that very long and rich dialogue, this is one of the points the Buddha makes about conceiving and asmimana. Bhikkhu, "I am," quote-unquote, is a conceiving. "I am this," quote-unquote, is a conceiving. "I shall be," is a conceiving. "I shall not be," is a conceiving. "I shall be possessed of form," is a conceiving. "I shall be formless," is a conceiving. "I shall be percipient," is a conceiving. "I shall be non-percipient," is a conceiving. Conceiving, that's manati in Pali. Conceiving is a disease. Conceiving is a tumor. Conceiving is a barb, a hook. By overcoming all conceivings, Bhikkhu, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. They are not shaken and not agitated. For there is nothing present in them by which they might be born. Not being born, how could they age? Not aging, how could they die? Not dying, how could they be shaken? Not being shaken, why should they be agitated? This is, a very rich little dialogue between the two members of the Sangha. Venerable Ananda gives that advice. But just to repeat the nun Jatila Bhagika's description of her experience, she said, "The concentration whereby neither pressed down nor forced back," so echoing that not standing still and not pushing forward, "still as a result of release, contented as a result of stillness, and as a result of contentment, one is not agitated." So there's the mixture of qualities of the experience of release bringing stillness, and then that stillness bringing contentment, and then that result of contentment is a freedom from agitation. This concentration is said by the Blessed One to be the fruit of what? Then Venerable Ananda said, this concentration is said by the Blessed One to be the fruit of awakening. So she's able to describe her experience, and then Ananda gives her that affirmation. Although this realization is, in its own way, remarkably simple, it cannot be overemphasized that, as with Venerable Anuruddha's enlightenment, it is necessarily based on a massive foundation of spiritual maturity. The nun who was speaking to Venerable Ananda was an arahant. The purity and simplicity of these accounts and these teachings can thus belie their depth and the sheer spiritual strength required to actualize them. So, any questions? Many of these passages are quite dense and difficult to follow in their detail, and that English is not the first language of many people here, and even for those for whom English is the first language, it's easy to get lost. So please do feel most welcome to ask any questions or anything that can be clarified. Please don't be shy. Yes, Ajahn Kachana.
Understands it so difficult. Awakening is not that frequently used as a description. My memory is usually more complicated than that. When the Buddha describes someone becoming arahant, there's a formula. You know, when Pali begins.
I looked up the words. That last sentence is, this concentration is said by the Blessed One to be the fruit of awakening. Then the Pali for that is Samadhi Anyapalo. Anyapalo, the fruit of awakening.
Okay.
Uto Bhagavati.
Yeah, because in some of the literature, when monks go to declare their awakening, actually they declare their Anya.
That's true. I'd forgotten that.
There's lots to forget.
Indeed, there's much to forget. Anya Palo, the fruit of awakening. Okay, so then to continue. The final issue to address in this chapter is the usage and meaning of the phrase merging with the deathless, Amato Gaddha. There are numerous occasions where the Buddha uses such expressions as these five faculties, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, when maintained in being and developed, merge in the deathless, reach to the deathless, end in the deathless. That's from a translation by Bhikkhu Nyanamoli in Sanyutta chapter 48. Or as an alternative translation, these five faculties, when developed and cultivated, have the deathless as their ground, the deathless as their destination, the deathless as their final goal. And then in the Anguttara, the Book of the Tens, this was a passage I was quoting very recently. Rooted in interest are all things. Born of attention are all things. Arising from contact are all things. Converging on feelings are all things. Headed by concentration are all things. Dominated by mindfulness are all things. Surmounted by wisdom are all things. Yielding deliverance as their essence are all things. Merging in the deathless are all things. Terminating in Nibbana are all things. And then from the Book of the Eights, mindfulness of death, monks, if cultivated and frequently practiced, brings great fruit, great benefit. It merges in the deathless, ends in the deathless. So that's Amato Gaddha is the Pali for that, merging in the deathless. So, what might be meant by, quote, merging in the deathless, or, quote, the deathless as their ground, destination, and final goal. In the Vedas, the image of the self, Atman, reuniting with the Godhead, Brahman, is a common characterization of the spiritual path. Many other expressions of spiritual knowledge also imply the language of, quote, becoming one with everything, or interrelatedness, merging with the universe, or the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, which is the way that the Light of Asia, written by Sir Edwin Arnold, that's the final grand passage of that, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, etc. And such language plainly endeavours to represent a gravitation of the heart towards truth, an aspiration that is intuitive to the human condition. Thus, it would be easy to read the statements on merging, quote-unquote, as a similar kind of spiritual return or union. However, the Buddha expended considerable effort to counteract this muddle and very carefully pointed out in numerous teachings that all these types of expression are subtly rooted in wrong view. For example, and this is from the invitation to the Brahma, the Brahmanimantana Sutta, is that right? Yeah, Sutta number 49 in the Majjhima. Having directly known that which is not commensurate with the allness of all, commensurate means the same thing as, or joined together with, or completely connected to. Having directly known that which is not commensurate with the allness of all, I did not claim to be all, that's A-double-L, everything. I did not claim to be all. I did not claim to be in all. I did not claim to be apart from all. I did not claim all to be mine. I did not affirm all. And then in the first discourse of the Majjhima, the root of all things, which is a long Dhamma talk the Buddha gave to some former Brahmins, the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the root of all things, they perceive all as all. Having perceived all as all, they conceive themselves as all. They conceive themselves in all. They conceive themselves apart or coming from all. They conceive all to be theirs. They delight in all. Why is that? Because they have not fully understood it, I say. This latter passage expresses some of the kinds of view that he criticized as eternalist, and thus one of the extremes to be avoided. The Buddha insistently spoke of the middle way as the path to freedom and peace. Therefore, it is most helpful to keep returning to that principle as the primal guide. Just as in a tightrope walk, there is both the constant danger of tilting too far to the left or the right, and the need for a relaxed yet alert attention to minor fluctuations of balance. Again, all analogies are partial, but the middle way as a tightrope walk is a fairly common one. It is a pronounced human tendency to lean towards either eternalism or nihilism, pushing ahead or holding back. The Buddha's teaching is unsurpassed in both analyzing and providing genuine means for counteracting such tendencies. Perhaps the clearest expression of this problem and its antidote that has come down to us in the suttas is found in Ittivuttaka, Sutta number 49. That was quoted earlier on. It's also touched on in the Udana, chapter 3, Sutta 10, and also in Sanghita, chapter 12, Sutta 15, so quoted in different places. When one reflects on the language the Buddha uses to express this principle of merging with the deathless and meshes it with his statements about the all, one can see that the image of the relationship of habitual sense perceptions, the all, to the deathless is more that of coming out of a dream and merging with waking reality, recognizing the coil of rope after fearing the snake in the grass, rather than a river merging with a sea of identical substance. So just to quickly go back to that passage from the Ittivuttaka that I think is very relevant here. This was said by the Lord. Bhikkhus, held by two kinds of views, some devas and human beings hold back and some overreach. Only those with vision see. And how, bhikkhus, do some hold back? Some devas and humans enjoy being, delight in being, are satisfied with being. When the Dhamma is taught to them for the cessation of being, their minds do not enter into it or acquire confidence in it or settle upon it or become resolved upon it. Thus, bhikkhus, do some hold back? How, bhikkhus, do some overreach? Now, some are troubled, ashamed, and disgusted by this very same quality of being, and they rejoice in the idea of non-being, asserting, good sirs, when the body perishes at death, this self is annihilated and destroyed and does not exist anymore. This is true peace. This is excellent. This is reality. Thus, bhikkhus, do some overreach. And how, bhikkhus, do those with vision see? Herein, one sees what has come to be as having come to be. Having seen it thus, one practices the course for turning away, for dispassion, for the cessation of what has come to be. Thus, bhikkhus, do those with vision see. And it's also in that same expression of what the awake mind knows is simply suffering arising, suffering passing away, dukkha arising, dukkha passing away. If instead we understand the language in this way, all dreams merge with waking reality, have waking reality as their ground, reach the waking state and have that as their end, the imagery still holds, but we are respecting the utterly transcendent nature of the deathless, just as the waking state utterly transcends the world of dream. Again, all analogies are partial, but that one is one I chose to use here. Now, it could also be contended that these passages, as quoted here, are not perfect renderings. For example, that a better translation of Amato Gadda would be gains a footing in the deathless, quote unquote, and that this discussion of merging, quote unquote, is thus all beside the point. However, the issue at hand is that of misunderstanding and the human habit of misreading things according to one's biases, often either eternalist or annihilationist. The fact is that the English phrases of merging with or plunging into, etc., have been frequently used by a variety of translators and have equally regularly been used to back up biased views of various kinds. Thus, it remains useful to contemplate these teachings as they have been transmitted to us, measuring them against known truths, and to find the middle way through our own reflection. I felt that was an important piece to have as the latter part of that chapter, and as I just said in those last paragraphs, it is quite common in using phrases like being one with everything or becoming one with the universe. Didn't the Buddha say merging in the deathless, or all conditions arise from the deathless, return to the deathless? And you don't find the Buddha saying exactly that. That kind of model, you know, the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, or that kind of imagery. The fact that the Buddha very clearly and specifically tried to avoid that and spoke at great length and numerous times to try and say, well, it's not quite an accurate form of expression. Obviously, it's imperfect, and there's various faults one could find with it, but that analogy of the difference between a dream merging with waking reality seemed kind of closer to the truth of things. And you can say, well, the waking world, that's just another bardo, Ajahn, that's just another refined kind of dreaming. Yeah, all analogies are partial, but I do feel it's helpful to contemplate, particularly if that's an image that you've cherished or that you've held as being, well, the Buddha teaches that we all go back to the deathless, don't we? And that sense of, well, what do the teachings actually say? What were the words he used to express that quality of realization? Even if it challenges our favoured views, like, as was mentioned before, in the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, that first discourse of the Majjhima, at the end of that, it's the very first discourse in that whole collection. It says the bhikkhus were not delighted in the Blessed One's words. They did not like him talking about not being one with the all, being the all, embodying the all, returning to the all, and so on. They didn't like it. And so it's right there, the first discourse. Those bhikkhus were not delighted in the Blessed One's words. Full stop. So I feel it's a strength of the teachings, and I've said that before, that the editors, I feel, deliberately put that at number one in the collection of the Majjhima. So not everybody who hears this, even the Buddha's own disciples, not everybody likes to hear what he has to say. And in terms of our own practice, particularly if there's the kind of models that we are fond of, or we're familiar with, or we take them to be absolutely true, is to take a step back, figuratively speaking, and say, well, let's consider that, or that assumption I've been making, or the way that I like to express things, is that really the case? What is happening here? How does this work? What is going on in the mind in those times, those moments of clear realization? What is this? So that we're taking these kind of principles and measuring them against our own experience in the practice, and not just sort of taking hold of a philosophical model that we like and say, oh, yeah, I think this is true and I don't like that one, but rather taking these principles, measuring them against our own experience and finding out for ourselves, well, how does it work? Or what is the principle that's is being represented here? What's the actuality? Any comments, thoughts on that?
Good, sir.
When we put that in the book, I mean, it was a long time ago, we edited this, it was a good 15 years ago, and then 10 years prior, putting it all together, we printed it 10 years ago. I wondered whether that would get criticized or people would find fault with that section of the book. But not just that, but to our mutual surprise, after we published The Island, there was remarkably little in the way of fault finding. Surprisingly.
Astounding.
particularly that section, I thought, well, someone's going to object to this, but not yet. Maybe it's so far off, people didn't even think it was worth the bother of correcting me. But I do feel these are areas that are worth contemplating. Just how that kind of casual use of language can be incorrectly quoting the Buddha. Not deliberately, but unconsciously, people can be misquoting the teachings and misrepresenting them.
Yeah, there's a lot of quotes of the Buddha out there that are pretty dodgy.
Yeah, the Buddha said that God loves us. Not quite. You got a question?
The space where everything arises and ceases, where it is not arising and ceasing, it's just knowing. That's how I experience the still point. My question is, when turning the mind towards that, which I usually don't do, like you said, it always gets sucked into the world. When turning the mind towards that, I sometimes feel like a sense of attunement, something is wrong, because there is a sense of trying to keep it there. There is a sense of like wanting to fixate on it. Like, even that subtle, it has a sense of like wanting to, you know, grasping feels like that, but even trying to place it there, sometimes I can feel this sense like something is not right in the way I do it, because it's, there is this, it's trying to hold it there. So I wonder whether Ajahn and Longpo has any helpful way of how we should hold that turning towards it in a way that is the middle way.
I would say the very fact that you can articulate that's what's being experienced, that shows that there's that aspect of the mind that knows that's going on. And that which is knowing that habit is occurring is not identified with that, is not commensurate with that. I mean, unconnected to or not the same thing as. It's knowing, oh, this is an event, this is a habit, this is a thing the mind is doing. So that which knows that habit, it's not that habit. Just that quality of, oh, look what this is going on. It can't just stop it. But that quality of, oh, look at this, look what's happening here. That in itself is a helpful step, if you like. Just the relaxation, going back to the tightrope walker, that I feel is a good analogy, because someone walking on a tightrope, they've got to be really focused, but they also have to be very relaxed. And so that kind of nonchalance, like, okay, dhamma, shmama, who cares really? Even if you don't really mean it, it's like pretending to be nonchalant. Rather, I got to, yes, look, oh, kind of breathlessly getting overstoked, like the Dhamma Nandiya, Dhamma Raga, that kind of. But even if you don't really mean it, just cultivating a kind of casual, like, easefulness. I like the word easefulness. Nonchalant. Even if you don't mean it, sort of plant the suggestion of, okay, realization, shmealization, you know. But just to kind of lower the adrenaline or the sort of, that sort of agitated habit of trying to fix or get or be. In a way, just knowing that feeling and appreciating it, just to recognize, oh, this is what they call the substratum of being, that kind of basic grasping bhava, the kind of urge to be. It's that kind of a tone. It's like this sort of basic grasping habit. Here it is. It feels like this. And that which is feeling it is not identified with it. I don't know, do you have any comments?
Yeah, just sort of recognizing that tendency to try to define, try to... How do I hold it? Or don't hold it. And it's that sense of being able to step back. So it's recognizing and then returning to... Basically, it's just this returning to the knowing without having to define or hold it anymore.
Without having to do.
Yeah, you don't need to do it.
Right.
The experimental musician John Cage wrote a book called Silence, because his most famous musical piece was 4 minutes, 33 seconds of silence, sitting in front of a piano with their fingers above the keys, not touching them. It's called 4 minutes, 33. John Cage wrote a book called Silence, and the opening passage of Silence is, if you let it, it supports itself. You don't have to. Each something is a celebration of the nothing which supports it.
Can you say the last bit again, please?
Each something is a celebration of the nothing which supports it. When you remove the world from your shoulders, you discover it doesn't drop. Hopefully that's meaningful. So that sense of, if you let it, it supports itself. Just that much is enough, really. You don't have to hold the mind or the knowing in place. It's present. There's no thing that has to be done with it or to hold it, keep it, support it. If you let it, it supports itself. You don't have to. So he did have a background in Zen meditation as well. But I feel that's quite an insightful statement in terms of mind training. It's all recorded. I think we have a copy of Silence in the library as well. It's the sort of thing one can Google easily nowadays. John Cage is his name. So I think that's enough for today.